She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Our show today is made possible due to the generous support of the University of Arizona. We thank them for their support and for the amazing, unbelievable work that so many of their faculty are doing to preserve this great planet of ours. And Megan's shaking her head. I haven't even introduced our guest yet, but she knows many of the same people. The name of our show today is Meet a Real Foodie, and indeed, that is just what we are going to spend the next hour doing. Our guest is Megan Kimball. She is the author of the recently released book, Unprocessed, My City-Dwelling Year of Reclaiming Real Food. And I'm telling you guys, my regular listeners know I'm prone to hyperbole. Well, get ready for this one, because I was reading the book, writing, are you kidding me? This can't be possible. How did she do this? The book is about Megan's almost unbelievable year-long journey of eating only whole, unprocessed foods. Like, ready for that? Eating only whole, unprocessed foods, and about her journey of exploring what unprocessed really means, why it matters, and how to afford it. Megan is also a founding editor of Edible Baja Arizona, one of the most successful edible magazines in the country, which you skyrocketed to that with a three-year anniversary coming up. And it's all about food in Southern Arizona. It's one of the most beautifully put together magazines that I have ever seen. So I want to say things like, you know, yikes and wow, but I'm a professional radio show host. So let's get started, Megan. Where to begin? It's an unbelievable journey. Yes, Michael Pollan has been a game changer, author of Food Inc. and the Omnivore's Dilemma and many more. And the other famous friend of ours is Gary Paul Nabhan, who's written, I think, 28 books at last count. Talk about a prolific author. But your book is one of the most amazing books I've ever read in my journey as Mrs. Green, because it's so undoable to me. And yet there are chunks that I took away that makes me think, I could do this, I could do that. I've had to reread paragraphs and pages because I couldn't believe what you had to do in this country, in this time, to eat unprocessed and reclaim real food. So first and foremost, thanks for being with us. And let's start by sharing your definition of what is unprocessed, because the whole conversation is going to be based on that. What is it?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I'm so excited to be here with you and on this show. I'm a longtime listener, so I'm super excited to be here. Right. What is unprocessed? That's a huge question and something I grappled with my whole year. All food is processed, right? Cooking is a kind of process. So is agriculture, preservation. And for most of human history, processing offered really great gains for human nutrition. It's only been in the last half century that those gains have begun to become undone with what one of my favorite nutritionists calls ultra processing. So, you know, high fructose corn syrup and all of the preservatives and artificial flavors that are in our food. And so it's a really tricky line to figure out what's too processed, really, is sort of the question for me. So I started my year with this kind of vague definition of a food was unprocessed if I could theoretically make it at home. So for example, in the book, I talk about how I got a little hand crank grain grinder and I ground up whole grain flour from wheat berries.
But I read that. I'm like, you're kidding. Yeah, okay.
It was so much fun.
There you go.
But I couldn't take that a step further and make, you know, refined white flour because I didn't have the chemicals and the industrial machines needed to do that. So that's just sort of one example of, the idea that if I could conceptualize how to make a food, to me, that seemed unprocessed.
And, you know, it even occurred to me in reading it, like, what does this mean? All food is processed. I'm like, how can she say that? Well, you can, because once the food is picked, the processing begins.
Right.
And it depends on if it comes to us in a really easy, better, less of a footprint local way, or if it comes from tomatoes that are grown in Wilcox, shipped to California, and then brought all the way back here. So it's highly processed.
Yeah.
So we have to go back, because I want you to talk a little bit about what led to your making this big, brave, and seemingly overwhelming commitment to eating unprocessed for an entire year in 2012. What was happening in your life that made you make this big, bold step into outer space?
Yeah, thinking back, it's I don't know what I was thinking. I mean, I had been reading all of the books that we've all read, Michael Pollan and Gary Knappin and Barbara Kingsolver, about yes. our food system and how, frankly, messed up our food system is, and how sort of incomprehensible a lot of the processes that bring us our food are. And had been feeling really overwhelmed and sort of uncertain about what I could do, how I could engage. You know, I was 26 at the time. I made very little money. I had no time. And so I felt sort of like, well, what can I do? What can any one person do to impact our food system? And so I kind of started at this place of, well, what do I want my habits to be? What do I want my consumer decisions to reflect? Well, you know, what are the values that I want my consumer decisions to reflect? So, I don't know how I sort of landed on the idea of unprocessed, but it seemed like a way in. You know, it seemed like a sort of conceptual framework that made sense. You know, it's in the same sort of ethos of Michael Pollan, eat real food. I wanted to try to do that and kind of test, well, that's a really nice thing to say, but how does that work on a day-to-day level? How does that work when you're busy and don't make money and when you don't really know what real food is? So it was a sort of like, it was also came out of a sort of frustration of feeling like I knew what I should be doing and having this sort of feeling of inability to do it, to enact it. So it was like, let's see, let's try it.
And I have to comment on sometimes the feeling in the whole sustainability area is people don't want to feel guilty or judged right. or whatever. There's none of that in your book.
Yeah.
There's like, this is my journey. This is what I did, and this is what Mrs. Green flipped out over. I was like, are you kidding me? I talked out loud a lot when I was reading your book. So when you were getting ready, did you have like some big fears, or did you just say, I'm doing this? And if you did have big fears, I don't know, assume that. What were some of the biggest fears that you had as you embarked in January of 2012, which seems like only yesterday?
Yeah.
And yet so much has changed. So we'll talk about that a little bit more. But what were you... What were some of your biggest fears? Because this was a tough one to take on in your life.
Yeah, it was definitely a really stressful time sort of entering into a modern supermarket and trying to figure out what I could eat based on these parameters. So, you know, the first time I went to Trader Joe's, which seems like a really natural food market, after I had decided to eat unprocessed, was a really stressful experience of reading the ingredient labels and figuring out what was actually in all these foods I had been so accustomed to buying. So sort of that figuring out of what I could eat was daunting.
And not starved.
And not starve. And, you know, I knew that I wouldn't starve because, right. you know, I know how to cook. Right. I feel like I had a grasp on whole foods and how to prepare them. The other thing that was stressful and daunting was the sort of social aspect of eating. I was really fearful at the beginning of my year that I would not be able to have that same sort of social connection with friends and family over food that, you know, is such an important part of eating and the culture of eating. And
everything
so,
in right. our, Maudie Bell.
Yeah.
She says mm-hmm. everything in the culture of food is so ingrained and it permeates everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. So that was, oh my God. And then I would think about things like going to eat at someone else's house.
Right.
Eating out.
Yeah.
All of those things. Like, what do? Like bring out your little Tupperware or just show up and do what you can.
Yeah. Luckily I had a really amazing group of friends who were really supportive of this funny project I started. And so,
they're not laughing
you know,
now.
They all kind of were, you know, I'd go over to someone's house and I'd be like, what's in the cornbread and what's in this? And they were all really patient with me, and same with eating out. Although I will say eating out was by far the hardest part of the year. Cause you just simply can't know what's in all of the food in a restaurant, you know, and I became that patron asking, is there sugar in your salad dressing? You know, how do you make your marinara sauce? What's in your bread? And so I asked a lot of questions and luckily would be with patient friends who were okay with that. But it was definitely a hard thing to figure out what I was willing to sort of compromise on.
And for you to consciously choose it is one thing, but your eating out is so, you make such a good point. Like we have friends that are truly gluten intolerant. And if they don't have someone that's informed, they get sick.
Right.
Like instantly.
Right.
I've been out with friends that just had to leave because some, you know, well-meaning waitress or waiter didn't know that was the hidden danger in the food for this person. So looking back, it's only 3 short years ago, which seems like forever, and yet yesterday, so much has changed. And that occurred to me when I was reading the book. Words that are now coming onto their own, like local, organic, and sustainable, are more in the mainstream language. What did the consumer landscape look like when you started? Very different. To think about it was only 3 years ago. So you were not, it wasn't everybody was talking local. Everybody was going to farmers markets. I mean, just the proliferation of farmers markets in the past 2 years in Tucson.
Yeah, I've been sort of delighted to see over the past 2 or 3 years that there's been more and more research around this area of processing about it's less important what we're eating than how we're eating it. So it's really not about the food, it's about the level of processing. And that, I think, it's been really sort of amazing to see over the past few years how that's become sort of a mainstream idea that, you know, it's not about don't eat carbs, don't eat dairy, don't eat whatever sort of newfangled diet it is. It's really just eat something that's close to its source. And that a lot of nutritionists and researchers are really proving that, you know, the sort of inkling I had that that was true, that's becoming a much more mainstream talked about idea.
And it kind of, the change for me being much older in earth years were things like knowing that you could eat tomatoes from the farmer's market, knowing your farmer, and put a little balsamic vinegar on them,
yeah,
which probably had sugar in it, for dinner.
Yeah.
Like that is a big change. Having a sweet potato.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Simple
to me,
cooking.
3 years ago, mm-hmm, not thinking about that. Okay, I want to do kind of a long one, but okay, I have to. I warned you about it. You talked about peanut butter in your introduction, and to me, it's so appropriate because who doesn't like peanut butter? Like, I don't think I want to know anybody who doesn't like peanut butter. And I want to read a quote from the book and ask you to comment on it. The quote begins, "Of course, peanut butter seems to have nothing to do with global warming, with communism or capitalism, but the more I learned, the more I realized everything is connected. Consumption in the wealth north and poverty in the developing south, the wealthy north, a changing climate, a food system that exhales almost half of the greenhouse gases emitted in the United States, political unrest in Latin America, and the policies we pursued at home. It's such a powerful connection to food." So it's a two-part question. Can we weave the connection? Can you weave for us the connection as what was happening for you, for that whole big connection? It's like a big green matrix and all the dots connect and you realize like food is at the genesis of a lot of this. World health crisis, wars over starvation, water, big, big, big picture. So can you weave that connection for us? And then I have to know if you're optimistic about where we are. Is it going to get worse before it gets better? So first one first. What was there an aha moment when you said, OMG, this is all connected? The synapses clicked, how far we transport it, how much the truck is using for gas, those kind of things, the packaging, the water.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's sort of a big, long story,
it's a big one.
Which I tell over 300 pages in the book, of course. But I don't think there was a specific aha moment. You know, I kind of tried to trace in the introduction moments that for me seem in retrospect to have been really influential. And so one of them was seeing Al Gore give his presentation of An Inconvenient Truth.
I was so jealous that you were there.
Yeah. And having that sort of moment that I think a lot of people had of panic of, you know, this is my problem. This is everyone's problem that we have to do something about. And then, so feeling that sort of real urgency around global warming, I grew up with a scientist for a father. So this has been something that's been a part of my life since I can remember. You know, I went to a presentation with him about peak oil when I was 16. So it's always been something that I've been aware of, but I didn't really know, you know, what can any one person do? Again, that's the sort of question that has driven a lot of my writing and a lot of this book is it's really hard to tackle big problems on an individual scale. And so thinking about that of like, what can any one person do? You know, and I talk about in the introduction, I lived in Nicaragua for a year after college, and that was really influential for my life in terms of thinking about how different systems work, how different people live, how different food systems and political systems and economic systems influence you know, how we live.
But let's press pause here. You have to talk then. I didn't have it as a question, but the thing about Nicaragua, you didn't just live in Nicaragua. It's like so glossing over it. It was in a little tiny village with 500 people, and there were lots of scorpions.
Yeah,
I remember, right. It's like, I really did read the book.
Yeah.
So do you just want to just do a little out of the box, what that was like and what happened for you and how courageous? I'm like, oh, I want to do this. And then I read like five more lines. I'm like, I will never do this. Ever, ever. I don't even want to go there.
Yeah. It's an amazing place. I totally fell in love with the country. I didn't expect to stay as long as I did. Yeah. So I moved to this little fishing village after college and taught English to the town's residents, and had this really kind of wonderfully simple life. You know, I walked everywhere. The streets weren't paved. I didn't have a cell phone.
Electricity went out. You
electricity
ran on the
went
beach,
out all
no
the time.
What.
It rained all the time. And that really changed my relationship to food because I didn't have access to all the food all the time. You know, it was just a sort of what's in the cabinet, what's in the pantry, what are the vegetables coming by on the vegetable truck, you know, with the man screaming that he has carrots. So it really sort of, gave me a new perspective on, you know, what, I guess the sort of like the richness of simplicity.
And how blessed we are up here.
Yeah.
We have five supermarkets on five corners. And if not, there's always the convenience.
But like, I mean, it's a blessing and a curse. I remember coming back and feeling so overwhelmed by how many choices there are. And I think I still have, I retain some of that overstimulation. Like I get overstimulated very easy in supermarkets and Walmart and Target. It's just, there's too much. And that all sort of like played into this idea of like, okay, the world is warming and we have too much stuff, too much food. Where does it come from? And we spend so much, you know, it's just so cheap and abundant, and having like kind of weaving all those together and having this sense feeling seemingly powerless, that kind of all came together in some sort of smoothie and food is the easiest way in, you know, it's a choice that we all make every day. And so it seemed like something that I could do, you know, and rather than feeling, you know, I would have to study for an environmental science degree or something, you know, you just make different choices about food and that, and collectively, we have an impact. And to answer your question is if I'm optimistic, you know, I think I refer to myself as a stubborn optimist. I think it's really hard to be optimistic because
I love that. I love that. Stubborn optimist.
Yeah. Like
you have to be.
Our system is so frustrating, and it seems like nothing is changing on a national or an international level. And so, you know, the farm bill has such crazy inertia. Oh. And so I think feeling all this, it's easy to feel sort of like defeated. And I often feel that way, but I think I kind of refuse to feel that way because then what do? You know, then there's nothing that can be done. We just accept the inevitable. And so I really believe in sort of like, if you and I and everyone else does things differently, then the system will change, you know, and it will take maybe longer than it should. But, you know, I think there have been a lot of examples about how the system has reacted to consumer, individual, collective decision-making.
And it's like, it's daunting, and yet it can be better than ever before. I go through the same journeys in my mind about the consumer coma, trying to wake myself up out of it. Because you go in the grocery store and you just push the cart.
Yeah, it's so
That's
easy.
That's what we did. It's yeah. so easy. And then all of a sudden you're at the checkout and like, what the heck is this?
Yeah.
And, you know, not going down the aisles is always a good thing. I talk about that. Just shop mm-hmm. on the outside of the aisles and you'll be a lot safer. I just want to ask you about the, the power of the people. Because I like to bring that up on every show. And I use the example of organic milk and Walmart shoppers. Mothers yeah. got mad and said, I don't want hormones in my milk. And Walmart changed. I don't want to ever hold them up as any kind of great heroes, but they did. So people have the power. And that's a thought that I would love to weave through this book. Your book made me feel more empowered. I realized I still have more choices. I still have a long way to go, but we do have all the power. Forget the farm bill. Vote with your purse.
Right. I mean, if we stopped buying food from General Mills, General Mills would go out of business. You know, if we stopped buying food from...
That's a great idea.
from, you know, if we stopped buying conventionally grown produce, there would just be no more pesticides in our watershed. And so, I mean, that's a really pie in the sky, almost naive idea. But I think that that's sort of... We have the power.
Dream big. We have the power. What a note to take a break. Everybody, please stay here with us. Our guest is Megan Kimball, Unprocessed, my city-dwelling year of reclaiming real food. Stay here with us. Lots of great more stuff to come.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at mrsgreensworld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at mrsgreensworld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the Igloo radio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmer Glass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@mrsgreensworld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Can you predict the future? The reality is we can't, but we can be ready for it. Funded by the National Science Foundation, researchers at the University of Arizona are working on a $3 million project to study the monsoon and learn about our changing desert weather, climate, and ecology. Such knowledge will help guide us to a more sustainable future, not just for our desert, but for the world. Now that's thinking ahead. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I know everybody has thinking on steroids going on in their brains. The name of our show today is Meet a Real Foodie, and indeed I have. Our guest is Megan Kimball. She is the author of the recently released book, Unprocessed, My City-Dwelling Year of Reclaiming Real Food. The book is about Megan's journey, her year-long journey of eating only whole, unprocessed food, and what she had to do that, and about her journey of exploring what that really means, why it matters, and how to afford it. Megan, thanks again for being here with
Thank
us.
You.
I said, okay, I'm a fan. It's okay. I like being a fan. Okay, perfect segue to something I want to weave into any interview, really the importance of supporting locally owned business. I was happy, and I thought, is she going to talk about Kimber Lanning in this book? Kimber's been on my show.
Yeah.
In the beginning of Mrs. Green's journey, I went to one of those presentations that she talked about, like 8 years ago, this little tiny petite stick of dynamite that's changing the world's landscape. And she talked about a 10% shift in your purchasing to locally owned. So can we give Kimber a moment and how she impacted you? Because you really do give her kudos in the book.
Yeah, I heard Kimber speak, I guess, 3 years ago, and it was a huge light bulb moment for me about why I was eating unprocessed and why it mattered. And the 10% shift is this stat that is my favorite stat, and I repeat it over and over, and I have to give thanks to Local First Arizona for it. And it's, if a community the size of Tucson shifted 10% of their spending to local businesses, together we collectively would create $140 million in new revenue for the city, which is kind of an incredible thought that, you know, just 10% is not very much. And what I also sort of realized when I saw Kimber speak is that also means that we're withholding that money from the balance sheets of corporations that are then using it to, you know, grow unsustainable food and influence national policies that may not really be serving our best interests.
And supporting Monsanto. I always like to take hits at Monsanto. It's such a cheap shot, but it's not above me. Believe
Precisely.
Me.
I mean, it's their money comes from somewhere, and it's really the consumers who can withdraw their support. And so, you know, also the benefit of a sort of, you know, why I find Kimber so inspiring. It's not only withholding our support from national corporations or multinational corporations, it's building healthy, vibrant communities, you know. So when you spend money in Tucson or wherever you happen to live, that money circulates through your community. And, you know, it has a multiplier effect. It ripples through your community and it comes back to you. You know, your roads are better paved. Your firefighters have better salaries. So that all kind of builds a sort of stronger network. You know, your local farmers make more money and hopefully can, you know,
expand
and have thriving businesses themselves.
And I think the easiest one to do, which is absolutely like it's the Bible according to Mr. and Mrs. Green, is when you eat out. If you are in any community, and I do it no matter where I go because we have Google, and I'll say best, I just went to Prescott, best highest rated locally owned restaurant, mm-hmm. or best Italian restaurant, or best locally owned Mexican restaurant. And in Tucson, if you just shifted that and stayed away from chains, which the food isn't as good, if you ask me, I can't remember the last time I did not eat in a locally owned restaurant, because you can just keep going through the list. Everybody does know your name. Like, I love to go to Renee's Organic Oven, where it's like a family hug from everybody.
I mean, and conveniently, too, locally owned restaurants often don't use those sort of additives and chemicals that chains do, because for a restaurant in Bozeman and a restaurant in Tucson, they need to have their menu taste the same. And so they use artificial ingredients to make that happen. Locally owned restaurants, you know, they it's supposed to be varied. It's supposed to taste different every time you go there. And I think that's a sort of wonderful side effect.
It is. And it's just a whole different feeling. It's just, and I say to people, they're the ones that are hiring your kids or grandkids to be busboys or waiters. They're using the local sign company.
Right.
They're using the local office supplier. I mean, it is that ripple effect. And everybody wins. It's not saying, you know, boycott anything else. It's like such a forward motion thing to
right.
me. Pay it forward and do it. Okay. In your book, you have what I call great takeaways. You have these little things at the end of chapters. And since we really can't cover the book from cover to cover, unless it was like a three-part show, I'm going to ask you to try to do the impossible and talk briefly about as many of them as we can before the next break, because there are lots of jewels there. So they're called Unprocess Yourself. And let's start with wheat. Which, what is wheat not in that we eat, or gluten? It's like, when I went down that rabbit hole, it's like, good luck.
Yeah. So I should say that each chapter begins with a sort of hypothesis of what makes that particular food unprocessed. And so, you know, I think it's different for every food. And so for wheat, I decided that grain was unprocessed if it was whole. And so the way to unprocess yourself is eat whole grains. So, you know, I still buy bread from the store. I don't always make my own bread, but you just need to read the ingredient label and see that it says some version of whole grain, yeast, and water.
And it's getting easier.
Yeah. It's getting so much easier. There's so many more amazing food companies out there who are making foods that with not crazy ingredients added. So that's one way. And then I think to just sort of, pay attention to how you're consuming grain and it's really easy to sort of like, I make, you know, a big pot of grains at the beginning of the week, and then I'll incorporate them into food. And so like into my lunches, for example.
Being prepared.
Yeah.
That's a big part of it, because we're all on the go. And it's really interesting to me about how far we've come. And I don't think you would have seen this in 2012, but I just came back from LA, and in every store, the big chains and everything, they had signs for local.
Yeah.
So bread, they were buying from locally owned bakers that were providing it, for produce, even for some of the canned goods.
Yeah.
It said local. So if you look and you're more of a discriminating shopper, it's not as hard as it used to be, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So especially like with wheat and bread, which, like, who doesn't like bread?
Right.
You can really don't have to go an extra stop and go to the bakery. Just read and see what you can buy locally. Okay, sugar. And I have to quote you on this one, because you're so relatable and honest in the book. If you're going to eat something sweet, make it count. And I am a certified chocoholic. The fact that sugar is really not good for us will not make me stop eating it. Life is too short to live without sweetness. Rather, knowing this makes me more careful about how and when I let sweetness into my life. So refreshing, so realistic. Talk about the sweet lover in all of us and how we can navigate this one. I loved it.
Yeah, sugar was a huge one for me. It was a really tricky thing to avoid. And I have a raging sweet tooth. In the book, when I was a kid, my mom instituted this rule called one sweet a day, because otherwise I would have just eaten sweets all the time. And I still feel that way.
I do too. I'm not kidding. Chocolate should be a food group.
Yeah. Me. Oh, absolutely. So one of the big things in my years, I learned how to make my own chocolate, because I couldn't buy commercially made chocolate bars. So I guess the point of that is, it what I learned when I started reading ingredient labels is that sugar isn't everything. It's in savory foods like mustard and marinara sauce and deli meat and bread.
Everything.
And that drives me nuts because, as I say, and there's lots of research out there, I would point you to Robert Lustig, who's a really wonderful nutritionist who talks about the impact of sugar on our bodies. So sugar's not good for us. So why would we want to have mustard with sugar in it? So my sort of way I think about sugar now is I avoid it whenever possible, except when I want to eat something sweet. So, you know, I really try to eat sweets that are made. During my year, I ate only honey, local honey. And local honey is really complex and filling, and it really sort of lingers, I think, a lot longer than just sort of table sugar does. And so thinking about ways that you can eat sweets that are satisfying, that will really hit that craving, hit that sweet tooth, and make you feel like, okay, I've had my sweetness for the day. I can, you know, go to bed.
And the health benefits related to eating locally, you know, produced honey, whatever the mm-hmm. word is, of fighting against allergies. I mean, there's so many upsides, the pollinators, but just buying, even then, again, think about locally owned honey. We've got great roadside stands here, mm-hmm. and we always stop, and it really, there's an incredible health benefit. So sugar, and I have to say this again, what I loved about your book, it's like, oh my God, she's not going to tell me, don't eat it.
Right.
Don't eat your, give up your candy. And it is like, I went from eating thinking Hershey's bars were good mm-hmm. to now eating, you know, environmental, fair trade, organic, dark chocolate. So Hershey bars make me sick. They yeah. don't taste good anymore. It tastes right. like wax in my mouth.
Right.
So that's a process that you can go on and still enjoy your sweet tooth and eat less because you can't eat as much, in
yeah,
my
and
opinion.
I think we're conditioned to expect things to be sweet. And when you kind of take that out, when you stop eating so many sweet things, I think you become more receptive to...
Your palate adjusts.
Yeah, your palate adjusts. And it's sort of, you don't need to eat as much sweet to get that same feeling of satisfaction.
I think about our team meetings for the Mrs. Green's World team. We used to, you know, we have them here at Mrs. Green's World headquarters, and we would have pastries mm-hmm. and all this stuff. Well, now we serve fresh fruit, we serve fresh salsa. It's so evolved because as Mrs. Green's World evolved, the team evolved, and it's been really incredibly great. Okay, let's talk about produce. We're both big fans of the Environmental Working Group. I've had them on the show at least twice a year, I think, since I've started. They are a content-rich production machine. It's yeah. like I could do a show a week. Heather White, unbelievable. The studies they do, just people need to connect. So the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. I love that you had it. Talk about that. You can't talk about it too much. Simple,
yeah,
easy.
Right. So the Environmental Working Group puts out a list, which is the Dirty Dozen, which are those produce items most contaminated with pesticides and those produce items least contaminated with pesticides, so conventionally grown produce. And the idea is, where can you get your most organic bang for your buck? So, for example, strawberries, I think bell peppers frequently top the Dirty Dozen list, which means that they're often contaminated with pesticides even after you wash
them. Like sometimes 17.
Yeah. So that means really it's worth to spend that extra money to go buy an organic strawberry when they're in season or an organic tomato or bell pepper because it's really going to have an impact on your health in terms of how many pesticides you're consuming. Whereas the Clean 15, really because of the way they're grown, onions, for example, just don't need that many pesticides to grow. And so as a consumer, I find that information really helpful and really empowering, especially when on a budget. It's really hard to buy all organic all the time because it is more expensive, rightfully so. But I think that information of knowing more information to make better choices is so helpful as a consumer.
And if the one thing people did in their life to start a change was connect with the Environmental mm-hmm. Working Group, the shift would accelerate.
Yeah.
I look at it for Center for Food Safety. I look at Center for Safe Cosmetics. They're coming out with canned food. And it's just an awareness. And they don't harp and guilt trip you. They provide great information about being an informed consumer, getting out of the consumer coma, and somehow they do it without preaching.
Yeah, I
agreed?
Think they do really great stuff.
EWG.org, yeah. And I'm, you know, whatever they're asking for, I try to help in every little way I can, sign a petition, give $10 a month.
Yeah, and because, they do really great research that,
oh my gosh,
you know, our federal agencies aren't doing, so.
And they're not taking any money from big companies
yeah.
at all. Not, they're, like, to me, impervious to the big lobbying mm-hmm. awfulness. Okay, let's talk about salt. Is there salt in everything too? I know there's sugar, but what about salt and what did you do about that?
Salt is in a lot of things. I mean,
it's a preservative.
It's a great preservative. I made my own salt just because, partly because I wanted to understand how these sort of like invisible additives come to be. You know, baking soda is another example. How did this stuff emerge from the world? And so it was partly just a curiosity of like...
It blew me away. You just have to tell a little bit about how you make your own salt. It was another one like, I went back, you know, you're reading, your mind's going fast. Then I went like, wait a minute, what did she just say? What did she just do? It was really great.
So you need an ocean. You need salt water to make salt. My parents live in Los Angeles, so I went to visit them and went to the ocean and collected, you know, I think 4 8-gallons of salt water.
Blows me away.
And you basically have to evaporate the water from the solid. And so I did it on a stove pot in my parents' stove, much to my father, the scientist's chagrin. It was like, well, of course you're going to make salt from salt water. But it was really very fun to sort of like make a food that seems unmakeable, I guess.
Never thought about it probably in my whole entire life. And I read it, I'm like, make your own salt. And you don't suggest that we do that. It was part of your experiment on your journey. Because isn't it okay or better? I mean, tell me what you really think to sea salt. Like, we've switched from the iodine little box of blue salt mostly to sea salt. You use less, you can taste it. Like, I put a little bit on my tomatoes when I'm having that for dinner. So good.
Right. And the sort of lesson I learned from salt is that it's really inefficient to make it yourself. And that was a good lesson as I was trying to unprocess and reclaim all of these different foods, is that there's a reason that we clustered together into communities and specialized, because it's really hard to produce your own meat and grow your own grain and milk your own, you know, make your own cheese and salt. And so I think to some extent, like, economies of scale are a good thing to a point, you know? And so I think having collective enterprises is a really useful thing. And salt happens to be one where it's much more efficient to buy salt that's made in a big salt works.
And again, I have to just underscore to everybody listening, get the book. Get the book, take your yellow stickies or something, you know, maybe that's a little bit greener. As I was doing it with the book, I'm thinking this is a lot of paper, but I'll keep it for a long time. Get the book and read this, because it is relatable. And the things that you talk about that you concluded to me are so doable on our everyday life scale. Okay, let's talk about stuff. This one for me was about walking the walk, getting out of the consumer coma, from using recycled toilet paper, which I admit I have not done, but chemical-free cleaning products. I invite everybody that comes into our house, go search. The only thing that you'll find is the hidden Clorox that we used to use. Now we use Fels Naphtha, which is much better. But what's the biggest takeaway you'd like to share with us about unprocessing ourselves from stuff? Can you do that in one? It's like, what a big, bold question.
Yeah, I feel like that might be the next book.
No kidding.
You know, that was a sort of divergence of, once you start thinking about all of the foods that you, all of the things that you're buying to put into your body, I couldn't help but think about all the other things I was consuming. And so I think that the way to unprocess stuff is to sort of be deliberate,
intentional,
in the same way that you are about food. To be intentional. And the sort of like collective power that we have to change our food system is also true of our stuff system, for lack of a better word.
And once you're aware of it, I think you start choking. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel. I feel like this sense of overwhelming. It's overwhelming. And I feel the same way that you do when I go in grocery stores or in a Target and I see the massive consumption. I wrote about it in my book, and that breathing thing starts happening. And I'm like, I don't want to become the person that doesn't, that nobody wants to be around. Okay, eating out, I think we covered that one.
That one is the takeaway there, is just ask lots of questions. Do your homework before you go and look at a menu. And really, I think that is try your best. It's really hard to be perfectly unprocessed at any given restaurant, but I think that speaks to the social import of food and like enjoy your meal and whoever you're eating it with. That was the sort of thing I had to kind of let go of, the perfectly unprocessed eating, into the sort of experience, which is so important of food, of reclaiming that sort of like connection.
And we have, to me, that's really underscore, do your homework, find locally. And we eat in like the same 5 restaurants.
Yeah.
That's what happens to us. Creatures of habit. Most of us are the same way. So if we have to go to break and come back with this one, which I'm famous for doing, starting a big, bold question, and then it's like a break. I want you to talk about drink, because that unprocessed drink, did you really make mead? It was hilarious. And do we have to give up our wine and beer? So I think we should actually not even start the answer to that because we have 1 minute. And everybody, I'm just going to do the segue now because we have 60 seconds. But with me, I am so really incredibly excited to have in studio Megan Kimball. She spent a year on this journey of not eating processed food or discovering what that was like. Unprocessed, my city-dwelling year of reclaiming real food. You can get it on Amazon.com, and we're hoping it's a national bestseller, and you heard it here. Everybody, stay here with me. Lots more good stuff to come.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Can academic research really save the planet? This year, the University of Arizona took full ownership of Biosphere 2. With 5 ecosystems enclosed in over 7 million cubic feet of sealed glass, Biosphere 2 is a premier facility for environmental research, where the top minds in the world will come together to address some of humanity's greatest challenges, such as climate change. Now that's using your brains. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us. This is the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And your thinking caps have to be on overload. I don't know how else to say it. The name of our show today is Meet a Real Foodie and Are We Ever? Our guest is Megan Kimball. She's the author of the recently released book, Unprocessed, My City-Dwelling Year of Reclaiming Real Food. It's about Megan's incredible year-long journey of eating only whole, unprocessed food, like press pause and imagine that, and about her journey of exploring what unprocessed really means, why it matters, how can afford it, and it also includes some commentary on political environmental implications, which we have to get to before the show is over. So let's just talk about a couple more of the takeaways. We were on drink. Don't make me give up my wine. And you have hysterical really examples in there of making mead. I underlined it and I said, this is not real. And then like flying leap.
Yeah. So alcohol was definitely a tricky one. I mean, conceptually, you know, I could have made wine at home, but it requires more equipment than I could afford. So instead I made mead, and mead is, some people say that one of the first alcohols that we humans drank, and it's really easy to make. You just do raw honey and warm water and let it ferment.
And what did it taste like? You said when you first tasted it, it was like, wow.
It tasted kind of bubbly and sweet, maybe more like kombucha than wine. So not exactly what you want when you're writing a book. You maybe need more alcoholic beverage. So I didn't make mead, but I also toured lots of local breweries, a local whiskey maker, and local wineries to talk to people here in Southern Arizona about how they make alcohol that's sort of representative of this place. And that's what's sort of striking about alcohol, is that it's really a distillation of place. And so there are people here making amazing wines and beers and whiskeys and other things. But that the budget really, that's where it hit the fan, is in the alcohol chapters. I simply couldn't afford that the amazing wines that are being made here. And so I had to make a compromise and buy cheaper wines that are made on a much more industrial scale using much more industrial processes. And so, you know, I don't think that we need to give up our wine, but it's definitely worth, I think, buying organic grapes when you can, buying organic wine made from organic grapes. And the local beer scene is exploding and is so accessible.
Unreal.
And I think the local wine across the country will catch up with that.
And the other point that I think is great to make, it's about your whole consumer. I call it the consumer coma. is that, and so many of the wine stewards in places like Trader Joe's or even Costco say, don't let price dictate your choice, because some of the less expensive wines are really good and undiscovered. So if you do your homework a little bit, you can get a cheaper wine that's still really good because it hasn't hit the popularity, you know, wine steward rating.
Right.
So I think that's another, you know, just be conscious and you can still have your wine. And when I started reading that, I'm like, she's not going to tell me to take away my red wine, is she? And you absolutely don't. You talk about things like integrated pest management, which was one of my first shows Bonterra was on. It was like 8 years ago. And I'm like, integrated pest management? What the heck is that? And it's you cover all that very readable and understandable. Using pests to control pests instead of spraying is basically what I call integrated pest management. But you're the expert. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I think that winemakers here are doing really great stuff to make wine, you know, the best way they know how.
In a really good climate, which is surprising. You'd think massive amounts of water. And I agree with you. Arizona was a shock that it's a good place to have wine. Okay. I have to do another quote. This is like the most quotes I think I've ever done on a show, but they were great quote. Refrigeration. The farther an ingredient is from its source when you buy it, the greater the burden is on you to figure out where it comes from and how it got to you. So talk about that, and then please tell your canning tomatoes story, because that is doable. You canned a bunch of tomatoes when they were in season. You sterilized the lids. That intrigued me. So talk about refrigeration.
Yeah, that chapter was really when I explored the sort of give and take between work at home and work, you know, time. Really, like, so much of reclaiming food means that you're doing more work at home. And what is the trade-off? Especially as a young woman, you know, the sort of legacy, I just assume that I'm going to be a working person in the world and not at home. And canning tomatoes was this sort of attempt to figure out how much I really wanted to reclaim and how much I really could. You know, I was lucky enough to live in Southern Arizona, where we have fresh produce year round, but most places in the country do not have that. And so preserving food is a huge part of, you know, living in a local food shed. And so I wanted to experience some of that. But sort of that quote that you read about figuring out how far a food is from its source, you know, I think that what I really don't want to do is, I want to be sort of moderate. And I think that what every person has to decide what makes a food to process for them. And that's really going to depend on the amount of time you have. You know, if you have four kids and you work two jobs, that's going to be a really different answer than it was for me or for someone else. And so, you know, it's okay to buy packaged food, but then the burden is on you to figure out how it's made. And if you really want to be giving that company that processed that food, your money. And so I think the point is to sort of like, figuring out the line of reclaiming processes at home or outsourcing that work to someone else. You know, there's a middle ground somewhere in between doing everything for yourself and letting companies do everything for you.
Yes.
And I think that middle ground is really interesting, and where each person falls on the spectrum is going to be different. And it's just about asking questions and sort of understanding where your money is going and who you're endorsing if you're not doing it yourself.
And what was so inspirational for me, and I've been doing this quite a long time, was that the lack of judgment, the steps to take away that help. And again, it's like that 10% or 20%. Mm-hmm. You don't have to like stop the presses, change your whole life, throw everything out in your cupboard and your refrigerator. Start incorporating new habits. That's what your book says over and over. Be conscious. Start, changing one thing at a time. And we have to really talk about, you know, 2012 versus now. And the amazing success, this is how my brain works, of Edible Baja, Arizona. I mean, you're a part of that. And talk about almost an overnight success. It is a magazine whose time has come and should be one of the steps you take is to get it, subscribe to it, support it, do whatever you can, because it'll make the journey easier.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the success of the magazine speaks to the level of interest that people have in their food system and investing in community. You know, we are as much about our local food shed as we are about our local community and all the amazing people, you know, producing food, selling food, making food, growing it, really. in this area and how that kind of forms community. And so speaking to the consumer power, we exist because there's a community of more than 200 local businesses that advertise in our magazine.
Right.
And so they pay for the magazine, they pay for the journalism and the photography that we do. And then we get to spread that awareness around the community. So it's a sort of really amazing symbiotic circle of, you know, you spend your money at a local business, they get to support another local business, which is Edible Baja Arizona. And then we get to do articles informing people about what's happening in this food shed.
And it's unreal. I mean, it's just, anybody, even if you're not from Tucson, I have a national and international audience, go to Edible Baja Arizona and check out what they're doing. Look at the covers. Everybody waits to see what is going to be on the next one. So a big shout out to that and the great work you're doing there. Okay, dairy. Huge issue, huge carbon footprint. What are your words of wisdom for the milk and cheese lovers out there?
Yeah, well, the first one is to eat full fat always, because why would you ever eat low fat cheese? You know, I did for a long time in my life, and it's not as good and it's not as satisfying. And my year of unprocessed eating was all about being full and satisfied. And always buy organic. I think that bang for your buck is hugely important in terms of the antibiotics and hormones that are getting into milk and getting into your body. In terms of the environmental footprint, which is definitely huge for dairy animals, I think it's always going to be a sort of give and take, you know, buy as local as possible. And in Southern Arizona, there aren't that many dairies. So I often end up buying dairy from California. So trying to kind of get something within your region, I think, is important. You know, I think for some people that environmental footprint is going to be really important and they're going to want to have soy milk or nut milks. For some people, the sort of the additives that are in a lot of commercial nut milks or alternate milks, so to speak, are going to make it worth getting, milk or other dairy products from animals. And so I think it's a really personal issue. You know, milk was our first food. And so I think people have really strong opinions about that. And that was something I found that In learning about the environmental footprint of milk, something inside me was like, no, I'm not giving that up. And I think,
get that.
And I think that there are foods like that that trigger that response in all of us. And so I think just being aware of that and sort of aware of our consumption is an important first step.
And it was so much easier for me and continues to be so much easier for me to eliminate meat than it is cheese.
Yeah.
And, you know, my daughter is on the vegetarian path and she says the same thing. Meat, no problem. She can't even pretty much look at it. But cheese and eggs, you know, in that, what can I eat? Those were tough. They continue to be tough.
And fortunately, you know, cheese and eggs, there are a lot of, I think, more than meat, that it's kind of easier to produce profitably on a local small scale. And so there, you know, I can think of a few great farms that are producing local eggs and they're really delicious and they taste so much better than commercial eggs.
And their yolks cheese, really are supposed to be,
you know,
dark yellow.
Cheese. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And cheese, you know, is preserved. And so there are a lot of really great local cheesemakers here in Tucson and around the country.
And I say to people, like, have you gone to a farmer's market lately? Because it's really not like going to Safeway.
Mm-hmm.
Not like I want to put any, you know, store down. But if you go to the local farmer's markets, of which there are many in Tucson, you get to know your farmer. They get to know your name. They save little treats for you because your face shows up. And it's vibrant and it's community and there's kids playing and dogs barking. And
yeah, it's more fun.
It's an experience.
Crucial. Yeah.
And they give out treats.
Yeah.
You get to taste things and have things like pomegranate ice pops,
mm-hmm.
which make me just love to go there when it's the hotter it gets. Okay, meat. It's the one, like I said, we found manageable to do in our lives to really cut down on meat. But is it simply eat less of it? Is that what you'd say the unprocessed meat part is in your book? Just try to eat less?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think there's a way to eat unprocessed meat, and it's to eat meat produced locally. I have a very hard time sort of incorporating the idea of industrial meat into any kind of eating framework that I'm okay with. And so I think finding the producers in your area that are making, you know, that are raising animals responsibly and slaughtering them responsibly, I think that's great. That is a great way to support the local food system and the local health. You know, animals are really good for agriculture. And so I think supporting those people that are incorporating them into their agricultural methods is a great thing to do. But That's more expensive. You know, the cost of meat in the supermarket is artificially low. And so we think that it's accessible and affordable, but it's not. We're paying for it in ways, including our taxes, which go to subsidies, including the environmental cost of industrial meat. And when you buy meat from a local rancher, you're paying the real cost of raising that meat. And so I think it's both eat less because of the footprint, but also because, you know, just it's more expensive. And so it should be, I think for me, meat marks occasion, you know, so I maybe eat meat once a week,
right?
You know, like a Sunday dinner with friends or sort of Christmas dinner or Valentine's Day, make yourself a nice
Thanksgiving
steak, you know. Yeah. I think it's a sort of like occasion bringing food. And so therefore it, you know, on that quick Wednesday lunch, it's harder to have the sort of gravitas I feel like it is required of meat.
And if you go to a local farmer's market, a lot of time you meet the farmer. Mm-hmm. You meet the person that's raising the cattle. You can ask them about how many antibiotics, because you can't, it's not true to say this meat is mostly antibiotic free. Even the organic farms, I'm going to have someone on the show after this one who spent a year working on 60 organic farms, both for meat and for vegetables, and the things that she found out are going to be kind of surprising for us.
And that's why I think local meat is so important, because you can ask those questions
and you know,
you can decide if
farm.
It's okay. You know, a farmer or a rancher is going to say, well, I gave him this antibiotic because of this. And you're like, well, that's a perfectly legitimate reason.
Right.
Okay. Or maybe it's not. You know, it's up to you to decide, but you'll be armed with the information.
And they tell you the truth and you can ask them. It's like you really don't have the same opportunity when you go to a big commercial market. Okay, hunger. And we're going to have to like go plow through this, because I want to get about the political implications and the importance of food scarcity, food security, terms we never heard in 1912. Okay. Hunger, such an important chapter and so helpful to me. Buy in bulk, connect with great organizations if you can't grow your own and you can't eat it all. So talk about the takeaway for unprocessed hunger.
Yeah. And I should say the premise of that chapter was I tried to eat unprocessed in the amount that food stamps recipients receive, which is about $20 a week. And I felt that felt important to me to sort of inhabit our industrial food system and try to, you know, I was lucky enough to have the wherewithal to get out of it, but a lot of people aren't. And so to figure out, you know, when you only have access to a supermarket, is this doable? And so the takeaway is, I think, to sort of make our supermarkets have better food, which is, you know, I think is a great transition into the political realm, which is that we have to change our political system around food. You know, the farm bill is the reason that there is so much cheap, unhealthy processed food in our supermarkets, which is what most people who don't have a lot of money can afford to eat.
It's disgusting. Like when you get into the meat and potatoes of the farm bill, did I really say that? It's really disgusting. And the lobbying rules. It's our compromised food supply. That's what I want my next to book to be while we were sleeping.
Yeah.
There was the farm bill and things like that. So talk about the political implications. We're already seeing some things heat up already in the United States. We're not as aware of it because it's happening over there, but food scarcity, drought, food security, water issues. What is your spin on some of the most important political things we should be looking at to focus on?
Yeah, I mean, I think the farm bill is a huge one. It's easy to sort of say that, but, you know, it's impossible to wrap your head around it. But the sort of idea is, you know, it's incrementally supporting more organic farmers and vegetable growers, but, you know, it's like 1% of its total budget, maybe less. So imagine if the farm bill spent 10% of its budget supporting local growers.
It would change the world.
It would change our food system.
You
know, and so I think being political, talking to your congresspeople who sit on the committee that passes the farm bill, and making, you know, and I think you can do that on a city and state level of expressing your support for local growers. You know, the state of Arizona also offers subsidies for growers, and typically they're not Sleeping Frog Farm or the people at your farmer's market.
Especially in Arizona. And you know what? I have been politically active for most of my life. You know, the ERA, that's how old I am. And when you know your congressman, doesn't matter. They say if they get 10 phone calls or 10 letters on anything, they start paying attention. So it doesn't have to be a movement of 10,000 people. We have 1 minute left and I can't believe it. It's like making me sad. So I hope your book becomes a national bestseller. And I mean that sincerely. I'm looking you in the eye. You're going to have books signings around the country. How do people get your book? and how do they follow Edible Baja Arizona? Your two shout outs.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm so thrilled to be on this show. It's been such a pleasure. You can go to my website, megankimble.com, and I have links to where you can buy the book, you know, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, IndieBound, HarperCollins.
Just buy it.
Just buy it. Your local bookseller. Speaking of local businesses, that would be a great way to support a local business. And then you can go to ediblebajaarizona.com to follow the magazine. We print the whole issue online, so you can read everything.
Okay, we're wrapping it up. Megan Kimble, thanks for showing up in my life. Happy 4th of July, everybody. Coming up next show, Sonia Faruque, Project Animal Farm.